Hello and welcome to the More Than Books podcast. I think we're at episode 39 now, which, you know, we're getting pretty close to 40.
We're going to have to do something special for 40, or maybe hold off until 50 and do something special then.
Yeah, we'll get there eventually. That's a year away still, probably. Yeah. But as usual, I'm your host, Joel, and I'm joined by Colin.
Yep, as usual.
Yep, and today, as we're recording, it is currently Banned Books Week, which is the American Library Association celebration of, well, anti-censorship, basically. They're celebrating books that have been banned or censored throughout the years. Mm-hmm. Now, in modern times, most of this is more like we have Harry Potter in school and someone complains that it has witchcraft in it, so it gets challenged. Mm-hmm. Books don't tend to get banned that often, at least in America. At least in public libraries, it doesn't happen that often.
Right.
In private schools and things like that, it happens more often, but it's not a huge problem these days, at least here.
Right, which doesn't mean that it's not worth bringing to light. I think part of the reason why we celebrate Banned Books Week is to make sure that we don't forget that this, at one point, was a bigger problem than it might be currently. Not that the occasional odd book burning or something still doesn't happen here and there, but like Joel said, it's usually something relatively harmless, like Harry Potter. So.
Yeah, and I think that's really what Banned Books Week is about, though, is looking at those historical, making sure that we don't forget and that we don't, you know, slide back into this kind of regular censorship or regular policing of what other people can read. I think the topic gives us an opportunity to highlight real serious issues in history and things that are happening now, even in other countries related to, and it may not be banning books, but it may be things involving free speech or the free press, or even having historical knowledge be attacked or try to be eliminated by people trying to create their own history. So I think the topics we're going to spotlight today are all kind of related to that overall theme. Mm-hmm. We're really focusing on, in some cases, things getting worse in some places, some cases things getting better in some places, and in some cases people risking their lives to preserve or save knowledge.
Yeah, and we're hoping to kind of cover all of that within both the modern era as well as provide some historical examples as well.
So I'm going to start things off with a fairly recent story about something happening in Turkey right now. And a little historical context. I mean, Turkey is has been a fairly free country for the last couple decades. I know that a couple decades ago, they were in a bid to get into the European Union. And with that, well, when a political party came into power in, I think, 2012. It might have been earlier than that. Let me double check.
Been around for a while, but I think you're right.
Okay, 2002. I was 10 years off.
Oh, okay.
So the Justice and Development Party came into power in 2002, originally in Turkey. And before that, the army was kind of the ruling party in Turkey. And so the Justice and Development Party came in with democratic reforms. They were trying to join the European Union. They were opening up some freedoms for the presses. They liberalized the press law, which introduced greater protections against state interference and strengthened journalists' right to protect their sources and replaced prison sentences for certain violations, which prison sentences for press violations, I mean, it's pretty serious. That's what happened before 2002, and well, they're backsliding pretty bad right now. Interestingly enough, the current president of Turkey came into power in 2002 as prime minister. So he was the leader of this party that brought in these improvements in their bid to join the European Union. I guess 6 years after that, 2008, they had a second election and stayed in power. And after that is when things started kind of going the wrong direction. In Turkey, the media is mainly owned by, I think 30% of the media is owned by a single company in the entire country, and they're very close to the president. Mm-hmm. So the Dogan Media Group owned 5 major national papers, numerous TV stations. So at this time, certain topics were off limits. So Turkey's constitution guarantees a free press in the constitution, but it also criminalizes reporting that threatens national security, and it leaves that vague. So they have,
as most constitutions do.
Yeah, what's left as a threat is vague. So they have used that that little rider in the constitution to go after anything that they claim is a threat against national security, and that mm-hmm. somehow includes anything negative about the president himself. So things started getting really bad after a couple years ago, I think 2016, there was a coup attempt, and they tried to oust Erdogan, who, as time went on after he became president, really was cracking down and getting rid of some of those freedoms that he brought with him when he originally came into power. After this coup attempt, huge crackdown, journalists were jailed, academics were jailed, members of the military were jailed. Like, people with careers were basically told they can never do that career again. They, mm-hmm. you know, they cracked down on the universities, they cracked down on all the papers, and now in Turkey, you can't say anything bad about the president on right. social media. That's a very recent story that came out, as people getting arrested for social media posts complaining about Erdogan. The newspapers and journalists self-censor themselves. They don't report on stories that may make the government look bad. Everything's very filtered through a propaganda mouthpiece, and most of the media is owned by one company at this point. And it's not good for journalists. I believe that this article that I have in front of me says that in press freedom rankings, Turkey is between Russia and Iraq on the list of freedom of the press at this point.
Not a good place to be.
Yeah, so you can imagine where that's at. This story is called How Did Things Get So Bad for Turkey's Journalists? Mm-hmm. The free press is always a casualty along the road to authoritarianism. And it was by Zia Weissi in The Atlantic in August of 2018. So it was just last year that this was published. I have a couple other stories related to it over the last few years. One is called Turkey's Climate of Fear for Journalists, published in January of 2019. And this one talks about how more journalists in Turkey are facing jail time, fines, or getting fired for trying to do their job. And one in the Columbia Journalism Review called What Remains of the Turkish Press. And it's basically how Erdogan took control of the media and handed it to a crony. So that was by Susie Hansen, came out this summer, 2019, in the Columbia Journalism Review. So you can see, very recent, still ongoing, and doesn't seem to be getting any better at this right. point. It just seems to be getting worse for Turkey. It's just showing how quickly things can change from a European Union bid and trying to present themselves as this secular, progressive right. Middle Eastern country. And, you know, Turkey is right between Europe and the Middle East. I mean, Turkey mm-hmm. borders Greece. Yeah, so this article, the How Did Things Get So Bad for Turkey's Journalists, points out that in his speeches, Erdogan regularly vilifies journalists as terrorists while stoking fears of terrorism among his voters. Mm-hmm. He eschews facts, voices conspiracy theories, including the idea that Turkey's allies are secretly working to undermine the country's economic might.
Right.
So,
and if that doesn't sound familiar, then
it's something we've heard a lot throughout the world recently.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's our first spotlight. A story I'll talk about a little later has a similar background, but has a more positive ending. So don't want to end things on a down note, but I'll let Colin spotlight his first story.
Right. So I guess kind of what we're doing is we're bouncing back and forth between the modern and the ancient. I put ancient in quotes. Some of it's not necessarily super ancient, but, you know, centuries past. Joel's going to be handling the modern stuff. I'm going to be handling the old stuff. So I guess kind of as an interesting complementary piece to what Joel's been talking about was, of course, the influence that the Catholic Church once had throughout most of Europe, and how certain conservative elements in the Catholic Church at that time were working very hard to suppress information that they did not like. One of the more infamous examples of this is, of course, the basically lifelong house arrest that Galileo was under after he published his dialogue concerning the two chief world systems, which was his defense of the Copernican view of the universe, which is the idea that, you know, the sun is at the center of the solar system, or as they thought then, the universe, and that the Earth and the other planets revolved around it, which at the time many Christians considered to be heresy, more or less, that it was anti-biblical. Copernicus, I guess you could say, had the good fortune to die shortly after his book was published, so he couldn't face the same kind of scrutiny, as well as his book was specifically written for an academic audience. It was not written for, like, a lay public. He was a mathematician, and he wrote his book for other mathematicians. Galileo, however, wanted everyone to be able to read this book. The dialogue is right there in the title. It's a philosophical dialogue, which, if you've never read one before, they're actually pretty great. A lot of people think of philosophy or science books as being big, awful, scary, boring, confusing nightmares to get through. But if you find one that's written in the dialogue format, they're usually pretty entertaining, pretty quick, very understandable reads, because what that format does is that it allows an author to basically develop fictional characters that are having a conversation with one another or a debate with one another, and each of them is bringing kind of a different, larger philosophical or scientific idea to the table, and then they're all kind of just hashing it out with one another. So Galileo, he wrote this book in a dialogue format. He wrote it in popular Italian, and he wrote it pretty, like, beautifully. Like, it's a pretty compelling, easy, delightful book to read.
Is it readable? Is it still?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I can't say I've read it. I've heard of it. I obviously know about it.
I've actually just reread it not too long ago, and it's great. It is quite a thick book. I have a copy of it sitting right here next to me. So it's not like the breeziest read in the world, but it is surprisingly easy. Nonetheless, because he wrote it to be read by a popular audience, he became a target of the Inquisition because he was spreading ideas to a populace, albeit an educated one, but still a non-academic populace that at the time was considered anti-biblical. We don't need to go through every last detail of his trial, but essentially it wound up with him under house arrest, effectively, for the remainder of his days. And it wasn't until, I want to say centuries later, that he was finally kind of given a formal apology by the Catholic Church. So that's kind of a considerably less modern example of that same kind of system which seeked to suppress information, important information. We're not talking about the press in Galileo's case, but we are talking about the expansion of scientific literacy, and that was not what the church at that time wanted to be done. The church used to publish a series of documents, I forget their exact name, the Indices of Prohibited Works or something along those lines. And for many years, Galileo's work, especially this particular book, that again is the dialogue concerning the two chief world systems, was on that list. That list was not completely done away with until the 1960s, by the way.
It's very modern still. If it was still on that list. I know that
Galileo's book was probably not on that list come the 60s,
but that list still existed
in the 60s.
Yeah.
Wow. I think 66 was when it was formally abolished.
Yeah, I'm looking at Galileo's Wikipedia article. So the dialogue that you're talking about, mm-hmm, concerning the two chief world systems was published in 1632.
Right.
And he died in 1642. Mm-hmm. So just 10 years of house arrest.
Yep.
Up until his death. It's interesting. I didn't actually realize, like, so Pope Urban the Eighth and the Jesuits were both big supporters of Galileo up until he published this book.
Yes.
So they were sponsors of him, I guess, at this time.
Right.
But he alienated them with the by being right. By being...
Essentially, yeah.
I guess history proved Galileo correct. And,
right.
You know, the sun is the center of the solar system.
Mm-hmm. Turns out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who'd have thought? I actually am going to... this seems like a good point to talk about what I was originally going to have as my third article, but I'm going to use it as my second.
Sure.
Because it does involve... it is thematically similar to my first article. This is kind of an inverse of it, but it involves the Catholic Church in a more modern time.
Right.
So in 1922, a little country named Ireland got its independence from the United Kingdom, or England. I'm not sure if the United Kingdom was officially a thing at that point. But,
again, yeah. Very complicated politics going on in this other completely different part of the world.
So. Yeah. So a little country called Ireland had a civil war and... you know, broke off from England, leaving behind Northern Ireland as still part of England.
Right.
But, you know, they started their own country after 3 years of civil war. And with the new government, Ireland was very Catholic. Ireland is still pretty Catholic, but it's not what it used to be. Yeah, so they had to come up with, their own laws and constitutions. And, you know, they originally started with film censorship in 1923. And this story that I'm looking at is called The Irish Writers Banned in Their Own Land. So this was published in 2017, and it was published 50 years after the Ireland censorship law was overturned. So yeah, it started with film censorship, and I guess the censor basically said he didn't know anything about films, but he knew the Ten Commandments. And
and that was popular in a lot of Western countries. At that time, most Western countries, including the United States and including Britain, did have film censorship boards, and you had to get your film passed through them before it could be distributed to the wider public. So
Yeah. So after they had the film censorship, it kind of... some groups wanted to expand the censorship. So Catholic campaigners in the 1920s wanted a shutdown on evil literature that was seen to be contaminating Ireland. And this is at the same time a bunch of very famous Irish writers got their start. a number of, award-winning, very famous Irish writers, people such as George Bernard Shaw, James Joyce,
yep.
Frank O'Connor, like a whole lot of popular, famous Irish writers. I'd say probably some of the most well-known writers in the world.
Yeah, definitely. Probably a lot of people would consider that to be the greatest generation of Irish literature, and subsequently had a huge impact on English language literature.
Yeah.
So
yeah, in 1929, they passed the Censorship of Publications Act, which created a board of 5 people appointed by the justice minister, and they could permanently ban a book or periodical if they considered it to be, in its general tendency, indecent or obscene,
mm-hmm.
or if it advocated or advertised contraception or abortion, or if it devoted excessive attention to crime. So those were kind of that was how it was laid out.
Sure.
And this board lasted, up until the 1960s. Pretty much.
Yeah.
So they started looking at, the British popular press, apparently, and ended up basically a lot of the British tabloids couldn't publish in Ireland at all, or they had to create a special Irish edition of their tabloid in order to publish. So, like News of the World and all those fun tabloids that everybody hates.
Right.
Yeah, had to have their own Irish edition. Nothing about birth control advertisements, nothing about, court reports and things that were more salacious details.
Sure.
Anything that suggested even the existence of, like, homosexuality, promiscuity, or prostitution was enough to have the book be banned. 10 Nobel laureates were banned, including Hemingway and Steinbeck, but As mentioned, a bunch of Irish writers as well. Frank O'Connor, James Joyce, Sean O'Casey. Mm-hmm. Got a huge list. One of which was Brendan Behan, which I think is interesting because Brendan Behan, very interesting person. I recommend looking into it. He's a little less well known, but he published an autobiographical novel in 1958 about his childhood. He joined the Irish Republican Army and got kind of caught up in the post-Civil War era in Ireland, and got arrested and was put in a British prison. And it was, yeah, he was very much a early IRA member before the IRA became, well, I guess the IRA was starting off around this time.
Sure.
Basically a group that wanted to reunite all of Ireland and have Northern Ireland rejoin Ireland. Very Catholic, very conservative, but they were also identified as terrorists a lot of the time. They carry out bombings and do that kind of thing.
The Troubles.
Yeah, it's a fairly recent that it's pretty much over, depending on how Brexit goes.
Yikes. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, Brendan Behan was an early IRA member, arrested and was in jail in England for a couple years. And it was while he was in jail that he became friends with a lot of British people in jail. And, you know, this story, Borstal Boy, a Borstal is a juvenile prison. So this story is about his time in this juvenile prison in England, where he became friends with these English Protestants while he was this IRA Catholic separatist, and how it broke down, basically made them more human to him, and he became friends with people, and he kind of lost his really hard edge beliefs. So that book was banned in Ireland in 1958, probably because of its devoted excessive attention to crime.
Yeah, if it takes place in jail.
Yeah. But it's a really good book, and it's a really interesting story. And what's really funny about this article I was reading is that Brendan Behan joked after he joined the list that they were the best band in the land. He made a bunch of jokes about how being banned in Ireland was kind of a badge of honor for the Irish writers. Like,
sure.
They kind of banded together, but they saw this as being a badge of honor in Ireland. Yeah, there's one quote in here from Brian Moore. Brian Moore remembered thinking it meant I was okay when he joined the list with Wreath for a Redhead in 1952. I guess that was the title of his book.
Right, sure.
Prohibition was the only laurel wreath that Ireland was offering to writers in that particular period. So they weren't giving awards to Irish writers.
Right.
So if they got banned, that means, in Ireland, that means that was their award.
Well, and in kind of a wider context, I mean, yep. We know, right, that if something gets banned or is controversial or upsets a lot of people, it might be an indicator of a mark of quality or interest.
Yeah.
Fastest way to get someone interested in something is to tell them they can't read it.
So in the 60s, Ireland was starting to kind of open itself up to the wider world, and banned books started being sold openly and reviewed and serialized, so their bans weren't actually banning at that point.
Sure.
And then in 1967, they passed a new Censorship of Publications Act, which repealed the permanent ban on books and replaced it with a 12-year ban that was applied retroactively. So any book that was banned and hit 12 years, like if it had been banned for 12 years, suddenly it's no longer unbanned. So up until 1979, about 400 books a year were unbanned, and then the ban was completely
done away with.
In the latter year, also, coincidentally, the partial legalization of contraception led to the lifting of the ban on birth control information, followed by that on abortion information in 1992. So by 1980, they legalized contraception, and so that kind of killed all of their censorship.
Right. Yeah.
Around those issues. So, yeah, what I found interesting about this, I studied abroad in Ireland a couple years ago. I guess 10 years ago,
that's
almost.
Say, more than a couple. The time flies, right?
Yeah, and Borstal Boy was a book that was on my required readings at University College Cork, which, yeah, I found interesting that a book that was banned in Ireland for so long ended up being part of required reading and curriculum later on. So
part of the canon of Irish literature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is a story about things starting bad and getting better. So mm-hmm. it's the inverse of the turkey story earlier, and it does show how things can change over time.
Right.
So just because something looks bad now or censorship is a problem somewhere doesn't mean it always will be, but it's also, judging from the turkey story earlier, we can't take these freedoms for granted.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, my next one is not quite as related, but it did spring up around a Civil War time. The next book I want to talk just briefly about is Leviathan by Thomas Hobbes, which was kind of written as a response to the 17th century English Civil War, which was a battle between the parliamentarians and the royalists, but I'm not going to get into all of that because all of that is extremely complicated and confusing, especially to someone who is not from England. But basically, his book is more or less a philosophical treatise on the nature of government and how government ought to function, as well as what government's relationship to religion ought to be. What's amusing about this book is that by modern standards, it's actually aged quite poorly in a lot of regards. It's still held up as a classic and as being kind of a foundational text of English political philosophy. And there are a lot of great ideas in it that we almost see the genesis of in this book that we take very seriously today, stuff like social contract theory and inalienable rights. But he also makes the point for tyranny quite frequently throughout the book, specifically his kind of vision of an ideal government kind of amounts to like hereditary monarchy, no separation of powers, no separation of church and state, the governing body being above the laws of the land, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like a lot of stuff that, you know, as a modern reader, especially a modern reader in a democratic society, we would take severe issue with. And amusingly, everybody took severe issue with it when it was published. I don't know who he was trying to please with it, but nobody liked it. The parliamentarians did not like it. They thought that he was painting them as a bunch of rowdy anarchists. The royalists did not like it. They accused him of being an atheist, which at that time was a pretty severe accusation. And he basically lived in self-imposed exile in Paris for an extended period of time. He was genuinely afraid that several people in high positions of power wanted him dead for one reason or another. What's great about it, and I think what makes it still worth a read today, is that, I mean, you've probably heard me talk about on this podcast before about how much I love old English prose, and this book is a magnificent example of that kind of Middle English prose. It's great. But regardless, it just goes to show that sometimes a book might be published and its author might receive significant heat and the book might be suppressed. And, you know, finally when it's widely read and widely available, I've got a translation of it sitting, or not a translation, a version of it sitting right next to me. You can read it and you think, oh, well, this book is, like, by modern standards, kind of problematic in a lot of ways. But does that mean that the book is not worth reading? No, it means that you're dealing with people from a different time who thought different things, and there's still a lot of excellent bits and pieces in it that you can pull out and that can still be applied to modern political philosophy and theology. Actually, I think the theology versions of the book have aged a lot better than any of the political theory.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I've read excerpts from that book.
Definitely.
In like Britlit 1 or English Lit.
Yeah, he's got
one
that,
or two.
You know, the famous thing about, you know, if we don't have government and all this other stuff, the life of man will be solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Which is kind of the big the big quote from the book. Oh, which is actually just like the very tail end of a much longer, even better quote. So go seek that out.
I've heard that in concert with, what is that other book? The Prince, Machiavelli?
Yes.
Like, yeah, I feel like that's come up in conversations together. I know that The Prince
they do frequently, yeah.
The Prince's isn't that written kind of satirically, though? Like,
I've not actually ever read The Prince, so I couldn't quite say. But yes, the two are commonly linked together as being kind of like two significant pillars of like European political thought at the time. And that both of them do have many germs of ideas that would later have great influence on a lot of political thinkers that, like, we would probably think as being more relevance to our times, like some of the American founding fathers. For anyone who's just interested in the evolution of political thought, it's a great read, but also reading up about just the way in which it was received at the time of its publication, as well as the life of Hobbes himself. He definitely had a pretty interesting time on planet Earth, and it's all worth checking out.
I feel like I should read that at some point. definitely seems worth it.
At least chunks of it. I actually quite love the back half of the book. Yeah. The first half, which is a lot of the philosophical, or a lot of the political stuff, can be a bit much. He kind of opens up with a rather nice kind of overview of his ideas about what it is to be, you know, a person, and what our relationship to each other is, and what our relationship to the environment is, and our relationship to the governing bodies of the land, that sort of thing. And all that's pretty great, too. It's just when he starts getting into the monarchy backed by a very strict church stuff as being the solution to all of our woes that it's easy to roll a few eyes. But yeah, yeah, it's still good.
Well, my last story is one that focuses on a rescue mission, and it's not even, it's almost like a rescue mission mixed with a heist in fairly modern story. I think this happened in 2014 or around there, or I guess 2012. So fairly recent, and a book was written about it that's pretty popular, and I highly recommend it. It's called The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu and Their Race to Save the World's Most Precious Manuscripts.
I have heard of that book.
By Joshua Hammer. And it tells the story of a book collector and librarian named Abdel Kader Hadara in Timbuktu in Mali, in Africa. It kind of tells his story. It's a man that in the 80s, he journeyed around northern Africa collecting, tracking down, salvaging tons of ancient, mostly Islamic texts and preserving them, but also a lot of secular manuscripts that basically just kind of collecting all of these books. He was very interested in history, very interested in preserving this history, and he donated them to a local library and built it up. So he had a private collection housed in the Mama Hadari Commemorative Library, including some things like a tiny Quran from the 12th century made of parchment of the dried skin of a fish. Interesting.
Wow.
Many secular volumes about astronomy, poetry, mathematics, science and medicine, surgery and elixirs derived from birds, lizards, and plants, written in Timbuktu in 1684. That's an interesting item
like
in his collection. But yeah, he collected all of these items throughout the 80s and 90s, and he had his own library. And so in 2012, he returned from a business trip and found that the army of Mali had kind of collapsed and been kind of taken over by a group of Al-Qaeda-affiliated fighters. Mm-hmm. So his country was basically taken over by Al-Qaeda, or at least his city. And with that, he was very worried that they were going to destroy these items, because a lot of, I know Al-Qaeda and also ISIS later on, they would target these historical types of documents, particularly things from early Islam, documents and artifacts that may go against their particular teaching of Islam. Mm-hmm. So I know that some of the things in his collection from early Islam showed the religion as being very open and peaceful, and they found it heretical to what they believe their version of Islam. This librarian, Mr. Hadara, organized a group to sneak the materials out of the library and hide them in people's own personal houses throughout town. So they need to take the manuscripts out of the big buildings and disperse them around the city to family houses. They don't want them finding the collections of manuscripts and stealing them or destroying them. What ended up happening was they bought metal and wooden trunks, about 50 to 80 a day, made containers out of oil barrels, found safe houses around the city and beyond, and then they organized small groups of people who would in the dark of night, pack the trunks with the books from this collection, and they would carry them out by donkey and get them hidden all over the place. So over 8 months, they packed hundreds of crates, found couriers and drivers, smuggled the manuscripts out of Timbuktu by road or down the river, past checkpoints, and in 2013, French troops invaded and kind of got rid of the Al-Qaeda group there. They pushed them out. They lost their territory there. But yeah, they managed to save about 400,000 ancient manuscripts. Yeah, it says by the time French troops invaded the north in January 2013, the radicals had managed to destroy only 4,000 of Timbuktu's nearly 400,000 ancient manuscripts. So it's quite the rescue mission.
For sure.
Shows how far some people are willing to go to preserve this ancient knowledge. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily a censorship story, but they would have destroyed these materials. So I guess in a way it is kind of a censorship story.
Right. It's a matter of, you know, someone being passionate about material that might be of cultural or intellectual or religious import to them or their community, and realizing that that material is a target of destruction by, even if it's someone not in power, still someone that's got the power to come in and actually carry out that destruction.
Yeah. So that's
a great story.
It's a very, yeah, very interesting story, and I highly recommend checking it out. Unfortunately, we don't have a copy of it, but I might recommend that we purchase one. But it's not, it's, the book came out in 2017, so it's pretty recent.
Yeah.
So it's probably pretty easy to find.
Yeah, so I've got kind of a parallel to this story as well, and it's probably what we're going to wrap up on. An ancient parallel to this story. Unfortunately, it's such an ancient parallel to the story that we don't know who the responsible persons for preserving these documents would have been. What we do know is that in the 4th century, churches in Egypt were told... Christian churches in Egypt were told that the only scriptures that they could rely on were, you know, the canon of the Old Testament and, of course, the New Testament. But anything that was apocryphal had to go. You had to remove it from your church's libraries. So someone outside of the city of Nag Hammadi in the 4th century stuffed a jar with 13 books of apocryphal texts, sealed it, and buried it next to a cliff. And we don't know if they ever intended to go back and retrieve those texts. We don't know anything about who did it, if it was a committee of people who did it, if it was one person who did it, whatever the case was. But those texts stayed in that jar by that cliff until 1945, when three brothers who lived in the area were on the hunt for some fertilizer. And they were digging around the base of this cliff because they had found nitrogen-rich soil there in the past. And they stumbled across this sealed jar and broke it open. I think they were hoping that it was going to be full of riches. And the story goes that they were slightly disappointed when it was just filled with old books. Unfortunately, they didn't quite realize what they had at that time. And it turns out that... they or their mother, depending on the account that you read, actually burned some of the pages either as a source of heat or out of fear that the pages contained something evil. But one way or another, all of these books eventually, although they were kind of sold piecemeal by the brothers over time to various different book collectors and antique collectors and priests, they eventually all wound up back in one place and have eventually been translated and published and are available to read. And they are the Nag Hammadi Library, more commonly known as the Gnostic Gospels.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, so this is, it's fascinating. So it's these 13 books, and they contained between them 52 treatises, six of which were duplicate, but 41 of which no known copies had previously existed of. Unfortunately, of those 41, 10 of them are highly fragmented, but that still leaves 31 complete or near-complete texts that were previously completely unknown. We had maybe just gotten references to their names and other literature that had survived to the modern era.
Were they basically the only copies of these, for the most part? There's not a whole cache of them hidden in the Vatican archives?
Well, not that we're aware of. There could be, but no, not that we're aware of. So if you're not familiar with Gnosticism, that's okay, because why would you be? But it's basically, it's kind of an umbrella term for a wide range of religious ideas that are based around aspects of like Judaism and Christianity and some Greek philosophy, especially kind of Plato. And it was, these ideas were kind of an early modern competitor to, or an early competitor to more like Orthodox Christianity. So different Gnostic groups believed different things, but kind of the common threads between them, insofar as they can be established, were that most of them believed that the creator of the universe, or if we're talking about Judeo-Christian Gnosticism, the Old Testament or the God of the Torah is an inferior God to the superior God of the universe. And that this inferior god created the world because he wanted to be worshipped in the same way that the superior god ought to be worshipped. So in Gnostic systems of belief, the path to salvation is, you know, knowledge of the truth of the universe, that you're going to get salvation by not worshipping the false god, the demiurge, but the true god. Which is...
I could see why that would be controversial in early in early Christianity.
Controversial today, even.
Yeah.
One form of it, Manichaeism, was briefly perhaps the most widespread religion in the world. It was definitely a serious competitor to Christianity, and it was actually the religion to which Saint Augustine originally belonged before he converted to Christianity. But it more or less died out in the 14th century, and at that point, the point at which it died out, it was primarily had migrated completely to China, and it was just a Chinese religion. But there is one group of fairly ancient Gnostics that have survived to today, the Mandeans, up until the invasion of Iraq in 2003, they were limited primarily to Iraq, but of course after all of that happened, they dispersed out outside of Iraq and now are kind of scattered all over the world. They're a small group, about 60 to 70,000, but they are out there and they do have a coherent belief system that's been followed for centuries. In fact, references to them exist in the Quran, so... And Gnostic movements do pop up frequently throughout history. Like the big example is the Cathars in the 12th and 13th centuries. And there was a whole crusade against just them, which put an end to that movement. But that was another Gnostic group. And Gnostic thought continues to inspire well into the modern era. There's still many cults and Christian sects and churches that are being formed on a regular basis that kind of revolve around Gnostic theories. If you've ever read any Philip K. Dick, dude was big into Gnosticism. But so these texts, when they were discovered, they were a pretty big deal. When they were translated, they were a pretty big deal.
You said that they were found in the 40s?
Yes.
Probably similar to like the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But yeah, some of the contents, you've got the Gospel of Truth, Treatise on the Resurrection, Gospel of Judas, Apocalypse of Adam, the poem Thunder Perfect Mind, and some of the stuff you may have heard of because it has had an effect on a lot of intellectuals and a lot of creative types. Carl Jung loved this stuff, and in fact, he, for a time, owned one of the 13 books that was originally found in that jar. So, as for the content, I mean, it's so wide-ranging that it's hard to get into. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's a lot of parables that are going to sound really unfamiliar if you're just kind of familiar with the biblical canon. All sorts of crazy, weird riddles, alternate cosmologies. Of course, the Gospel of Judas is kind of recasting Judas as a hero figure and the receiver of the true gospel. And additionally, there were some Hermetic texts as well in this library. Hermeticism is a whole nother mode of religious and philosophical thought that was kind of bubbling up in that time. And yeah, translations widely available, and you can get all sorts of translations. You can get ones that are very academic, and you can get ones that are actually quite nice to read, kind of written in, you know, the way that we expect scripture to be written. So And it's all thanks to some intrepid person who was probably Gnostic or sympathetic to Gnostics, who realized that if I don't hide this stuff, it's going to be taken from us and lost. So it just took so many centuries for us to rediscover it.
I mean, I've heard of the Gnostic Gospels. I guess I didn't quite know the whole story about them being found in a jar.
Yeah, that's the crazy thing. And it was just completely an accident. They weren't out there digging for stuff like that. They were looking for fertilizer.
All right. Well, that's our collection of stories for this episode. Yeah. Some positive, some negative, and some with happy endings, and some with endings still to be seen.
Right. Hopefully happy.
Yeah. But yeah, as you can see, censorship is still a problem. It's still something that is a serious issue, a lot more serious than just, conservative parents not wanting their kids to read Harry Potter.
Right.
Yeah.
So. Although that's something, we can be angry about too. Not to take that away from anyone.
Yeah.
But, there are more serious things that sometimes we neglect to talk about during Banned Books Week. So that's why we wanted to highlight it here.
All right. Thank you. Until next time.
Yeah. Have a good one.